Good evening. Welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight, I'm pleased to offer a discussion of bankruptcy law. Some types of bankruptcy and the answer to some bankruptcy questions are simple and obvious, while others are more subtle, such as when to liquidate and when to reorganize. Tonight, we'll be discussing the legislative scheme that protects the use of bankruptcy so you or your business can get a fresh start, or perhaps it's time to cut your losses. Similarly, bankruptcy law often protects certain creditors, perhaps less so others. How does a consumer or family member know when it's time to pull the plug? How does a creditor know if all this is on the up and up? Well, for starters, you can give us a call tonight. Our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. And again, if you would like us to pay the freight, call us at 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, which is bankruptcy or credit-related questions. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. And as always, our attorney guests are happy to answer all of your questions. We stop short of giving precise legal advice without all the facts relating to a given case, but we're more than happy to pass along the legal principles that can help you in your decision-making. All of my distinguished guests tonight are very well-known to Silicon Valley lawyers, but are all here for the first time on Your Legal Rights. With a focus on civil litigation, primarily business and real estate, professional liability, judgment enforcement, commercial collections, and representation of creditors in the U.S. bankruptcy court, Justin Dre is a partner at Greenfield LLP.
Thank you, Jeff.
The immediate past chair of the business law section of the California Lawyers Association, Monique Jewett-Brewster, is an attorney at Hopkins Carley Litigation Department and Financial Institutions and Creditors Practice Group in the San Jose office, with a primary focus on representing secured and unsecured creditors in the restructuring and enforcement of complex loan transactions in state, district, appellate, and bankruptcy courts nationwide.
Glad to be here.
From the Santa Clara firm of Bender and Malter, Michael Malter is an AV-rated attorney with over 40 years' experience representing businesses and individuals in bankruptcy and bankruptcy-related matters, and is one of only 9 attorneys in Santa Clara County certified by the State Bar of California as a certified specialist in bankruptcy law.
Thank you, Jeff.
Ryan Penhaligon is an attorney at Structure Law Group, LLP. His practice is divided between in-court and out-of-court work. His in-court practice includes bankruptcy and commercial litigation and representing clients in a wide range of business, real estate, and commercial disputes with a particular emphasis on debtor credit rights and insolvency matters.
Thank you, Jeff.
And Ryan, Monique, Michael, Justin, welcome to all of you to Your Legal Rights.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Who'd like to jump in? What I'd like to start with is just a quick summary of what bankruptcy really is.
Go ahead, Michael.
Thank you, Justin. This is Michael. Bankruptcy is the opportunity for the good but unfortunate debtor to get a fresh start. We talk about honest folks who have gotten behind or are having difficulty with debts, whether individuals or businesses, who are looking either to get a fresh start and begin again or to reorganize their debts.
So can we give a little bit of a history of how we got to this point? Just what was bankruptcy historically and what it is now?
Doesn't the word bankruptcy come from breaking the bench, right, of the Italian merchants? And if they ended up not paying, their bench was broken, so they could no longer do business. Isn't that right?
I'll buy that.
It's for me.
I think that's correct.
It also has, it has biblical roots. There was the idea that once every 7 years, people could be freed of the bondage of debt, and that debts would be forgiven. So there's very ancient precedent for it. But in the United States, we basically are a country that promotes entrepreneurs. It's the main blood of the United States. We allow for the possibility that businesses may fail, and that the individuals who tried but failed get to try again. And that's a real distinction between the U.S. and many other countries.
Now, that suggests to me some presumption that the debt was honestly acquired. And are those generally built into bankruptcy law, and are they often defeated?
And I'm sorry, Jeff, could you repeat that question?
Sure, and I'm hoping that I'm coming across well. We're using Zoom once again because we're not in the studio. But your answer to the last question suggested some presumptions about how the debt was acquired. Anybody care to jump on that a little bit?
This is Justin. Go ahead. This is Justin. The type of debt affects how bankruptcy can help an individual. Certain types of debt is dischargeable, meaning it can disappear or go away with an effective bankruptcy, and other types of debt are not. So when you're looking at whether bankruptcy is right for you, the nature of your particular debt will dictate whether you're eligible or whether it's even a good idea to consider bankruptcy. Specifically, some types of debt, like arising from torts or a drunk driving accident or unpaid wages to an ex-spouse, stuff like that, student loans may not be dischargeable under the circumstances. And Michael, did I cut you off?
No, you were fine, Justin. This is Michael. I was on the same path that if someone commits fraud, they can't simply file bankruptcy and walk away from their fraudulent conduct. It's also true that if a debt is secured, if there is particular collateral underlying the debt, that debt is not wiped out in bankruptcy. So, for example, if someone has a home and has a mortgage on their home, the mortgage is not wiped out just because they file bankruptcy. If that was the case, every American would file bankruptcy in the next 10 minutes.
Very good point, Michael.
And the people that are owed money, the lenders in Michael's example, are called the creditors, and the person who files bankruptcy or the business, that's the debtor. So we speak of them in terms of debtors on the one hand and creditors on the other hand. And those are the two adversarial parties to any sort of bankruptcy case, because one side is owed money and one side owes the money.
And for the individual debtor, the goal of the bankruptcy is to receive a discharge, to get free of the debt which was dragging them down. This is one of the few contexts in life in which the word discharge is a good thing.
You know, a moment ago, you mentioned that the two adversarial parties are creditors and debtors, but aren't there a lot of cases where the real adversarial parties are different groups of creditors, some that may be able to protect themselves and others that maybe out of luck?
Well, at the end of the day, everyone's fighting over the same piece of pie, and the creditors amongst themselves have different rights depending on whether their claim is secured by an asset like a house or property, or if it's an unsecured creditor like a credit card. They're treated differently and they have different rights.
Yeah, and they're very often, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, but in the reorganization cases, the creditors are separated or grouped into different classes for treatment under a plan. And so different classes of creditors often receive different treatment. As Michael mentioned, if a creditor has collateral, they're in a wholly different situation than, say, a trade creditor or a supplier, someone who supplies goods or services to the debtor, and they have no collateral.
So let's talk a little bit about the different types of bankruptcy cases. The one that everybody knows about is Chapter 7. Is that the same, whether it's a business or an individual?
Well, no. This is Michael. If it's an individual, the good news is that the individual continues to live after filing Chapter 7. For a business, it's really the end of the business. Chapter 7 is a liquidation proceeding. So for a business, whatever assets can be liquidated are liquidated by an agent of the court called the bankruptcy trustee. The bankruptcy trustee basically garners the assets to try to liquidate them to pay a dividend to creditors. For individuals filing bankruptcy, the goal is to wipe out as much unsecured debt as possible, retain their assets so that they're not losing assets which are near and dear to them, so that they can take a deep breath and get on with their lives.
And happily, we don't liquidate them.
Correct. Well, if we really don't like them, we may, but just kidding. No, they are not liquidated. They go on. Many famous Americans, including Harry Truman, Walt Disney, filed Chapter 7 and went on to become great successes.
You know, we've read in history about some of the names of businesses that we're fairly familiar with and how they were treated for falling behind in their debts very differently in history as the way compared to how it looks today. Wasn't it the case not too long ago? I mean, when I say not too long ago, I'm probably thinking 150 years. But in the scheme of history, weren't people treated quite differently when the country was being founded? If you started a business that ended up taking from your creditors and the like, you could actually be jailed?
Yeah, that takes us back to the history. I was joking earlier about the concept of breaking the bench for bankruptcy, but in England, there were debtors' prisons. So we joke about individuals not being liquidated, but at the same time, historically, debtors who weren't able to pay have been jailed. So things have progressed a great way since then.
And I think really, Monique, that is one of the key concepts of bankruptcy law in the United States, is that we did away with debtors' prisons. And my own philosophy is that bankruptcy is a recognition that people can be imprisoned, at least figuratively, by their debts. And if they were never able to have the opportunity to shed those debts, they could be feeling imprisoned the rest of their lives. But we reject the notice of debtors' prisons, and likewise, we promote rebirth through bankruptcy.
That's a good point, Michael.
So what other types of bankruptcies are there for businesses?
Really only one, right? If a business isn't going to liquidate and it wants to possibly emerge from bankruptcy in some way, shape, or form as a going concern, then I think Chapter 11 is the only other option. Although, you know, as we talk about today, Chapter 11 recently had a makeover, so to speak, with respect to certain laws that were recently enacted that somewhat adjust your normal Chapter 11, but really that's your business reorganization case. The JCPenney, the Whiting Petroleum, 24-Hour Fitness, those cases are Chapter 11 cases, and the debtors hope to emerge from bankruptcy leaner and able to make a profit.
And this is Justin, and the only exception to that would be agricultural farm businesses, which have their own chapter.
That's very true. I wasn't thinking about family farmers. That's Chapter 12. Most of the business reorganizations that you hear about on the news are Chapter 11.
Correct.
And Monique, what's the goal of Chapter 11?
I've never seen a Chapter 12 in my business, but I knew that there's one more.
That's very true. It's best to be accurate that that is available for if you're eligible.
Do we really have that existing in this general region, or is that something that we think of out in, you know, in the Midwest?
No, actually, in the South County, South Santa Clara County, it's not that unusual. As you head towards Salinas, other communities that are more agricultural communities. Chapter 12 is actually far more common. We just, the four of us happen to be in the teeming metropolis of San Jose, so we're a little jaded.
And something tells me you probably won't have a Chapter 12 filing very often in San Francisco. Just a thought.
That's a good guess, Jeff. But the a very exciting development, and Monique was just alluding to it, is there's actually a new type of Chapter 11. As a debtor's attorney, I'm very excited about it. Through a rare bit of good timing on the part of Congress, Congress at the end of 2019 passed a legislation called the Small Business Reorganization Act, the SBRA, which created a new type of Chapter 11, referred to as a subchapter 5. One of the big problems with Chapter 11 that I've banged my head against the wall over for 40 years in practice is that Chapter 11 is extremely expensive, often prohibitively so for small businesses, small to mid-sized businesses. The fees to file Chapter 11 can begin at $100,000. So it's very, very expensive. But Congress, in a rare bit of wisdom, understood that there should be relief for small to medium-sized businesses and passed the SBRA. This law was passed, became effective on February 1, 2020, frankly, just in time for a pandemic. So for small businesses, medium-sized businesses now suffering from, as we all are suffering under COVID-19, subchapter 5, the SBRA, provides a whole new avenue of relief, which is a very efficient form of reorganization, far less expensive than Chapter 11, with some very good advantages for debtors and some real disadvantages for creditors.
So, Michael, are you telling me then, and this is Ryan, that a subchapter 5 isn't good for creditors?
That is correct. And I bet Justin and Monique would love to talk about that.
I'd love to hear it.
Sure. You know, I'll go first. I joke, but it was almost prescient that Congress passed this law and was signed in and went into effect in February, because, like Michael said, debtors really need that streamlined alternative to Chapter 13, which is also a reorganization chapter, but there are limits to your eligibility depending on how much debt you have. And then the expensive big Chapter 11s. It's just that in the SBRA cases, they move much faster. There are shorter time frames in terms of when the debtor has to file a plan of reorganization in an SBRA case. And also there is less leverage for creditors. We've talked a little bit about how creditors can have secured or unsecured claims. There's some strategy for a creditor that may hold a claim that has a big deficiency part, a part that exceeds the value of the collateral. And in an ordinary Chapter 11 case, you might control the general unsecured creditor class and vote against your plan and just have the debtor's plan and have leverage. Creditors don't have that under the SBRA. That's just one example. A second, quickly, is there's no creditors committee. There's no official committee of unsecured creditors, which is often appointed by the U.S. trustee in an ordinary Chapter 11 case. And that's the voice of the unsecured creditors. Unless there's cause to appoint a committee in an SBRA case, one's not appointed. So those are just two changes between ordinary Chapter 11s and the new subchapter 5s.
Anybody else want to jump in on that? Hearing no one, let's talk about the last type of bankruptcy that we really haven't talked about for individuals, but we discussed it, reorganization, as it relates to businesses. What's the parallel with individuals?
The parallel for individuals is Chapter 13. This is Michael. Chapter 13 is a form of reorganization for individuals. Basically, it's a 60-month payment plan in which the unsecured debt is paid often a percentage on the dollar over a 60-month period. Chapter 13 is most utilized where the individual would otherwise sacrifice assets in Chapter 7. If the individual's assets cannot all be protected, very often they will look to Chapter 13 as another form of relief.
I'm just making a note because it looks like we lost Justin.
Oh, no. Okay.
So I'm sending a message to the studio so that they know let him back in when he gets here. Before we get there, it's actually, if we was going to jump off, it was a good time. If somebody was going to do thinking about filing under the pandemic, it was a good time for that. But you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight we have a distinguished panel lending a view of really the view of 10,000 feet looking at bankruptcy. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. And again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You don't have to jump into the exact point we may be in our conversation. So having laid out the types of bankruptcies, let's start talking about what to do. For example, I really need to file a bankruptcy, but I'm flat broke. How do I go about it? How do I pay for it? What do I do next?
Well, that's a rather common question. Debtors' attorneys like myself face. This is Michael. Frankly, how do I pay for bankruptcy? The answer is before the case is filed. But the serious point is that where individuals understand that if someone is going to file bankruptcy, if they have to file bankruptcy, they're going to stop paying all of their unsecured debt. They're going to stop paying credit cards. They're going to stop paying on personal loans, because those debts are just going to be jettisoned in the bankruptcy anyway. And dollars that would have gone out on those payments are dollars that can be collected to pay the legal fees for the bankruptcy filing. Different firms have different fee rates. As always, folks should be good consumers and compare fees, but also compare experience. We live in a world in which you get what you pay for. So it is a caveat emptor, consumers beware.
So who's eligible to file? Who's ineligible to file?
Well, individuals are eligible to file. Anyone really, any individual or business entity can file Chapter 7. If it's an individual seeking to reorganize, as long as their unsecured debt is under $419,000, they qualify for Chapter 13. Or if their unsecured debt is not greater than $1.25 million in secured debt, like mortgages, car loans, etc. In terms of Chapter 5 or Subchapter 5 that we were referring to, the debt limit was $2.3 million. But under the CARES Act, the emergency legislation to provide relief from COVID-19, that debt limit was increased to $7.5 million through the end of March 2021. Chapter 11 has no debt limits. It's available to individuals, to business entities as well.
Are there anyone that's ineligible to file?
Trusts cannot file. There are really very limited entities or individuals. I can't think of any individuals who simply can't file. And as to entities other than trusts, it can't be used as an estate vehicle because there are probate courts. Otherwise, it really is open to individuals in all forms of business entities.
Chapter 13 is limited to individuals, I recall, from learning that the hard way early on in my career. So that's another limitation on eligibility.
That's right. So corporations are limited to Chapter 7 or Chapter 11. Individuals can file Chapter 7, Chapter 13, or Chapter 11.
And Chapter 12, let's not forget about our family farmers.
Thank you. Thank you.
And our municipalities is Chapter 9.
Yes, Chapter 9, right.
Putting aside Chapter 9s for a minute, focusing on 13s and 11s, don't most of those, I mean, isn't there a fairly high percentage of those that eventually convert to a Chapter 7?
That's actually an excellent point, Jeff. And there is, if you were to look nationally at the statistics of Chapter 11s, which go all the way through a plan of reorganization to confirmation, the statistics are depressing. The failure rate is about 90% or greater. Wind up in Chapter 7. Frankly, I chalk that up to bad lawyering. Good bankruptcy lawyers are going to size up the case before it's filed, have some idea of what the exit plan is going to look like. There are unfortunately lawyers who will tell clients, we'll file your Chapter 11 or we'll file your Chapter 13 because that will get you instant relief, and it will. But the relief will not be long lasting if they don't have a plan in mind as to how the person is going to exit from bankruptcy as well.
Michael, that's probably a good time to bring up what the relief is. If you're filing and you're ultimately not going to have a successful bankruptcy, what's the immediate benefit? And you're talking about the automatic stay, which is an important topic for the listeners to understand as an overarching protective mechanism and the reason behind running to bankruptcy court sometimes.
So do tell, Justin.
Well, the automatic stay is essentially a protective shield around the debtor that prevents the ability of any creditors to take action against the debtor or their assets while the bankruptcy is in place and the automatic stay is alive. There's ways that creditors can seek to get that lifted or have it dissolved. But while it's in place, you cannot foreclose on a debtor's property. You cannot levy their bank accounts, garnish their wages. So it gives significant breathing room to the debtor while they either effectuate their bankruptcy plan or buy themselves breathing room to come up with something else.
What I like about the automatic stay, too, is that it is what it sounds like. It's automatic. You don't have to do anything but file the bankruptcy and everything stops. As Justin was saying, no foreclosures, no evictions, no repossessions, lawsuits stop, everything stops automatically.
As creditor lawyers, we have the same idea. There are significant consequences to violation of the automatic stay. So creditors beware.
Creditors can go from a decently leveraged position in being owed money to being on the defensive end of a nasty violation of the automatic stay action, which is very unpleasant.
You know, we've spoken of an automatic stay in the context of other areas of law, such as family law, when a dissolution action is filed. Is it essentially the same idea? We freeze everything at the status quo until we have a chance to really take a look and reassess?
Yes. I think that's exactly right. Yeah, it's to marshal the assets so you don't have creditors running, you know, one by one into court, exercising the rights Justin was talking about, trying to foreclose. It's to preserve the estate until the debtor has the opportunity to really figure out, you know, if they're going to reorganize, how to do that.
And it's not only for the debtor, to give the debtor a break, but it's also because part of the bankruptcy code is fair treatment of all creditors. Mm-hmm. And it's, and so that it's not a just catch as catch can, creditors can all be taken care of.
Yeah, and this is Ryan. One thing it really does is it prevents the rates to the courthouse if you're a creditor. It prevents, you know, getting your trial date as quickly as possible, sometimes taking shortcuts and trying to enforce a judgment that you get to the disadvantage of other creditors. So it really does provide for an orderly mechanism amongst creditors to make sure that there is equal treatment.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. Once again, 415-989-1616 or sfbar.org.
And once again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we have a distinguished panel of attorneys lending a 10,000-foot view of bankruptcy. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're not in San Francisco and you want us to pay the freight, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question about bankruptcy or creditors' laws. You're not limited to the point we are in our conversation. So call us at 866-798-8255. So let's talk a little bit about how it all works. How does one start? How does one file a bankruptcy case?
It might be worth, before jumping into that, talking about what you shouldn't do before you file a bankruptcy case if you're thinking about it in the months leading up to it. Namely, that is running up tons of credit card debt or paying family members and friends who you might have borrowed some money from, or otherwise preferring one credit over another before you run to the courthouse and seek your fresh start. There's consequences and they're grave. Just a caveat.
Good point, Justin.
When you talk about grave consequences, what kind of consequences could somebody face?
This is Justin. Well, if you're gonna pay one creditor because it's a family friend or someone you just don't want to get into the bankruptcy mess, then the trustee of your bankruptcy can come back and try and reclaim those funds as under what's called a preference payment, where you've preferred one over the other. There's typically a 90-day reach-back period for those kinds of claims. But other stuff that could come up is fraudulent transfer lawsuits and various other claims against the debtor or third parties they might have worked with to avoid creditors or conceal assets in the time leading up to their filing.
You know, creditors can also file an adversary complaint, which is really a complaint in the bankruptcy case. And if their debt was really arose through the debtor's fraud, then they may seek to have that debt held non-dischargeable, meaning that the debtor's personal liability for that debt will survive the bankruptcy case.
In my world of criminal law, I know there can be some consequences too. I remember years ago when I was clerking, I just realized how many years ago that was, back when tablets weren't small computers, but rather things you chipped in with a chisel. But we used to see a very rare case of bankruptcy fraud where somebody moved assets around just after they filed bankruptcy, or maybe even just before, in order to evade the creditors and the courts. Do we see many of those things occurring still?
Well, it certainly can happen. I mean, the thing to remember is that bankruptcy is federal law. And the folks filing bankruptcy, whether businesses or individuals, are going to sign statements under penalty of perjury, which still means something. So whether there's concealment of assets or false statements made, that's a federal crime. And it can be punished and prosecuted as a federal crime.
I think you mentioned the U.S. trustee or earlier on, somebody did, it could have been me, but that's the arm of the U.S. Department of Justice that acts as a watchdog in bankruptcy cases. So if a trustee becomes aware that, for instance, the debtor hasn't disclosed significant assets, the trustee make a referral to the U.S. trustee to investigate. And I have seen occasions where debtors, they were very fraudulent, they were very extreme, but I have seen a debtor imprisoned for 6 months in federal prison for bankruptcy fraud.
I do want to say, though, this is Michael, those are rare instances.
Very rare.
In 40 years of counseling individuals, my clients typically really are the honest but unfortunate individuals or businesses. Certainly meriting a chance to reorganize or get a fresh start.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with the meritorious individual. They really do have a claim and something to do. What's the first thing they should do? They're about to file a case. How do they get started?
They should go seek competent counsel is the first thing they should do. This is a serious proceeding. For most people, it's a once in a lifetime event. It's a very, very serious event. Unfortunately, bankruptcy is up there with death and divorce as one of the most traumatic things an individual may experience. But it's very, very important that it is done right because, again, it's going to be a once in a lifetime shot. So I would urge any individual or business looking to file bankruptcy to very carefully research attorneys in the area of bankruptcy law. Make sure you're going to see somebody who specializes in the area, someone who says that they do wills and trusts and divorce and everything under the sun. And by the way, I also do bankruptcy, is probably an attorney to stay away from.
I see that in all areas of law, there's still a fair number of attorneys who think that they really, if they're a lawyer, they could practice anything. And unfortunately, there's still a number of people out there that tend to go to those attorneys. Not everybody that practices in areas that call for specialization do nothing else, but usually they do only very few things. They tend to be related, ancillary to that main area, and it tends to make for better attorneys. So if you're a bankruptcy attorney that does a lot of business litigation or things that are related to it, it makes sense.
Yes.
When you're a bankruptcy attorney that likes to do some personal injury, they like to do some criminal, they really like to mix it up, probably not a good place to land for any of it.
Mm-hmm. Especially for the complex cases. You know, I don't think you want to go to an attorney who dabbles in bankruptcy when you've got a complex situation. You want to go to someone who has a specialty and expertise in it.
Yeah, I liken it to going to a general practitioner if you need heart surgery, right? Not something many people are going to want to do.
I actually had a description of that in my website where I described it as exactly that. You wouldn't want to take your child with appendicitis to, to somebody who's a chiropractor. There's nothing wrong with being a chiropractor, but they're not necessarily the one to go to when you need surgery. Right now.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what their experience is going to be like. You go to the attorney feels that it's a good time for your business or for you to file. What are you going to experience next? Just talk a little bit about what they're going to experience.
You know, honestly, Jeff, this is Michael. The hardest part of the process is to set that first appointment to go see an attorney. There is a huge emotional bridge folks need to get over in going to seek help. It's hard for anyone, any of us. It's a humbling experience for sure. But once they do go see the attorney, what they will hear is that the preparation for a bankruptcy filing itself is frankly pretty mechanical. And there are very set milestones in terms of what's going to happen in the bankruptcy case. The attorney is going to compile a good bit of information from the individual or from the business to complete the bankruptcy schedules. Once everything is completed, once the client has very carefully reviewed the finalized paperwork, they give their blessing to file, we push a button, and the case is electronically filed, and they're in bankruptcy automatically. There is no Wizard of Oz that needs to wave a wand and decree who can or cannot be in bankruptcy. It is a constitutional right, and that bankruptcy filing occurs as soon as the button is pressed.
And Ryan, I'm going to give you the flip side of that question. We talked about someone's experience when they're going to file for bankruptcy and the need to get counsel and how complex it is. Suppose you're a creditor. You've lent somebody money, or perhaps you've invested in a business and you get served a bankruptcy filing and you realize that your investment may be going away. What do you do?
Well, the first thing you need to do is like if you're a debtor, you need to get competent counsel. You need to find out that counsel understands the bankruptcy process, has an understanding of the process and procedure for filing proofs of claim in bankruptcy, understands generally how the bankruptcy code works, and at the end of the day can understand and advise you what your rights are under the bankruptcy code, depending what chapter the bankruptcy is filed under, and really what the process looks like, because it can be a long process and it certainly can be complex, especially if it's a large Chapter 11. And there is nuance and procedure, and it's critical that creditors understand their rights, because there certainly are things that can be done to protect their rights in the bankruptcy under the bankruptcy code. And in fact, from a creditor standpoint, it's actually oftentimes good when there is a bankruptcy filing, because it brings all the assets under the auspices of the bankruptcy court. It provides for an orderly procedure where creditors' rights are heard along with the debtors. And so it often is a very good process for creditors to try to get some money.
What about someone who owes back taxes? Do the standard bankruptcies we've discussed work?
It depends. It depends on a number of factors. The most prominent is the age of the tax debt. There is a certain time period after which tax debt can become dischargeable. That is typically the general rule is 3 years, but there are all kinds of landmines. I always remind my clients to remember that the bankruptcy law is federal law. And in enacting the bankruptcy code, Congress didn't really care a whole lot about credit card companies, but certainly cared about its own income. So the path towards getting discharged of tax debt is absolutely one of running a long field with many landmines that can take a tax debt and make it non-dischargeable or not wiped out in bankruptcy.
So what do we do about those IRS calls, or for that matter, does the IRS call?
Well, the IRS, Justin earlier talked about the automatic stay, and the automatic stay applies even as to the big bad IRS. With the filing of a bankruptcy, any collection action by the IRS stops, it ceases. If there is a payment plan, for example, through Chapter 13 or Chapter 11 or the new subchapter 5, the tax debt, if it's not dischargeable, can be paid over time through a payment plan. But in the bankruptcy court, the IRS is a special creditor, but just another creditor.
Michael, they're special. The IRS is special because they often are priority. Is that the case?
Yes.
A priority creditor?
Right. So if the tax debt is not dischargeable, then it has to be paid in full with interest. However, it won't get penalties. So very often it's penalties and late charges that can mushroom the tax debt over time. If the tax debt is in fact aged to a point where it can be dischargeable, then it is no longer a priority debt, but just another debt like a credit card debt or a personal loan.
The IRS has obviously a lot of tools at its disposal, but in general, they send letters rather than calling, right?
I'm sorry, in terms of their collection?
Yes. I mean, my thought going in is that when we get calls that say they're from the IRS, they're probably fake, aren't they?
That's very often true. There are a lot of scams. The poor consumers really are at the mercy of a lot of scam artists. The IRS, you're right, Jeff, will more typically send out an audit letter or notice of a lien or a collection proceeding. What is typical, frankly, is that before the IRS takes heavy action, they usually have provided a series of notices, of warnings. So the prudent consumer should not ignore those notices or stick their head in the sand. If there's a tax debt, go see a qualified bankruptcy professional to look at possible relief in regard to the tax debt.
What about someone who doesn't pay what the IRS is asking? I mean, what do they stand to lose? Can they go to jail?
Well, that depends. If the debtor is engaged in willful evasion of the taxes, yes, that's a crime. And people can go to jail. You know, the basic rule that we did away with debtors' prisons and we're loath to throw people in prison over debts is true. But if somebody has engaged in nefarious conduct, in fraudulent conduct, and it's really certainly true as to the IRS, but true as to other creditors as well, they are going to pay the consequences.
What types of debt cannot be discharged in general?
Certain fines, penalties. I represent a municipality in bankruptcy matters. And so when they have a claim that includes fines and penalties, I'll check the code and see if there's any way that we can argue that those should not be discharged as compared to, say, a money judgment or even our clients' attorney's fees, because the policy behind that type of fine and penalty is such that the debtor should remain liable for it.
Yeah, and another big category is one that most people would think of as fraud, which is willful and malicious misconduct. So an individual cannot go out and defraud somebody and file bankruptcy and get the debt discharged. And so there's some nuance there, and there are some categories within that. But as a general matter, debts that are procured by fraud are not going to be dischargeable.
Generally, is it fair to sum up by saying that the bankruptcy laws are meant to be a sword and not a shield? I said that backwards. Generally intended to be a shield rather than a sword, so you can't go out and run up your credit cards and file the next day or commit some sort of fraud. But rather, this is meant to protect people that are coming at it with good faith and need that extra help.
That's a fair statement. It's also true that if you look at harm caused to others, it depends on how the harm was caused. If I'm in a car accident in which I was negligent in getting into the accident and the claim against me is greater than my insurance policy limit, I can wipe out that claim in bankruptcy. But if I engage in intentional conduct, if I'm driving drunk, if I am driving recklessly and someone is harmed, then that debt will typically not be wiped out in bankruptcy.
And the last question I wanted to ask you, I want to give each of you about maybe 2 minutes to sum up any last thoughts. But the one question first I wanted to ask is if there are circumstances where otherwise dischargeable debt might not be dischargeable. Are there times when you make a huge mistake and suddenly you can't discharge something? By way of example, you mentioned tax debt that becomes right. dischargeable. I would imagine that it might be a big mistake to file it a little too early.
Right. That's exactly right. That's fatal. The, you know, where we talk about if a debt is more than 3 years old, that means 36 months. If someone files the bankruptcy in 35 months, the tax debt is not dischargeable. And there is not a right to exit that bankruptcy and then hang out for a month or two till it becomes dischargeable. You're stuck.
And Michael, that highlights the importance of finding specialized bankruptcy counsel if you're seeking to get rid of debt of that nature. I don't know if you recall, you and I have even had a case years ago involving an attorney's failure to carefully time the date of filing the bankruptcy so as to account for the implications on the dischargeability of tax. So it's not something that someone can just pick up and Google around. It's very technical. The timing is crucial, and not just the debtor can get themselves into trouble, but an attorney trying to represent a debtor on that kind of thing can get themselves into trouble as well.
Yes, Justin will sue you.
And that leads me to my next point, which is that I also offer professional liability services for plaintiffs.
We knew you'd get that in there, Justin.
So thank you. We're really running out of time, and I wanted to give each of you, we have about a minute and a half for each of you for any parting words or thoughts. Who would like to jump in first?
This is Ryan. I'll go. And I'm not going to take that long, but if there's one takeaway I think that everybody should have, it's the bankruptcy code and the bankruptcy process is complex. It's complex if you're a creditor, it's complex if you're a debtor, and there are things that you can do with planning to protect your interests, regardless of what side of the aisle you're on. So retain competent counsel, talk to competent counsel that knows what they're doing, that has experience. It is complicated. If you're a debtor, there are ways out. And if you're a creditor, the fact that the debtor is filing bankruptcy doesn't mean that you're not going to get paid anything. Sometimes it means the opposite, but it is complex. It does require planning, and it does require counsel that understands the process.
Well said, Ryan.
And who would like to jump in next?
I'll go next. This is Monique. I guess the takeaway I'd like to share is just, you know, even if you're thinking I wouldn't be impacted by a bankruptcy case because I don't, as a creditor, I don't do business with anybody who's distressed, you know, not so fast. Just know that we are expecting a historic rise in the number of bankruptcies being filed due to COVID-19. And so you may think that you are safe, but if you get a notice of bankruptcy filing, go to your counsel, go to competent counsel who has experience in bankruptcy, because as everybody has tried to impress today, it's extremely complex. And I know just representing creditors, you think, well, maybe banks, there are financial institutions, but if you are a commercial landlord, you could be a creditor if your tenant files. If you do business with a mom and pop, you know, who sells widgets, you could be a creditor if they go into bankruptcy. And if they want to reorganize, they may want to essentially continue to perform under your contract. And you may have defenses that. So just know that whatever your position in a bankruptcy case as a creditor, whether you have collateral or not, go see your counsel, because there are deadlines in bankruptcy. So you need to move quickly and you really need to understand what rights you have.
Who's next?
This is Justin. And Monique, it's as if you were reading off my outline of final thoughts. So what I'll do is I'll make a general statement, which is a cautionary statement to people out there who may be a creditor in any bankruptcy. Respect the automatic stay. Don't try to take actions on your own without hiring counsel because you may step into something you don't realize.
Good points.
And Michael, why don't you bring us home?
Yeah, this is Michael. The, you know, I think the pandemic epitomizes why there is such a thing as the bankruptcy code. For most individuals who file bankruptcy are filing because of circumstances beyond their control. I can't think of a circumstance more beyond any of our control than the pandemic. And for the individual who has lost a job, for the individual whose hours have been cut, there is relief and there is no shame in seeking that relief. You no longer wear a scarlet letter B on your head if you need to file bankruptcy. And I will simply say that I see individuals absolutely in all walks of life. Doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs. No one is immune to suffering, especially in regard to the pandemic. And as to businesses, it's also true that the reasons as to why one business is a raging success and the other is not very often have to do with circumstances of fortuity and beyond the control of the individual. I have clients who were brilliant restaurateurs who are now suffering terribly because of the pandemic. That is a classic situation beyond their control. I'm very, very thankful that there is a means for those businesses to regroup and be able to carry on. It is essential to our society that individuals have the opportunity to be free of their debts and go forward and be productive members of society. It is essential to our society that businesses have the opportunity to regroup and to continue to be productive members of commerce.
And if there's one thing that I've walked away with tonight, it's that we're often talking about quite a bit of money here for individuals or businesses that are going down this road, whether they're filing, whether they're a creditor. We're talking a fair amount, and to try to do it yourself and make mistakes is a huge mistake. To try to save on the legal fees seems to me as penny wise and pound foolish in this complex area of law. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We've been trying to give you a view of bankruptcy from 10,000 feet with a distinguished panel of attorneys. Our guests tonight include Justin Dre, a partner at Greenfield LLP, with a focus on civil litigation and collections representation, representing creditors in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court. Monique Jewett-Brewster, an attorney member of Hopkin Carley's Litigation Department and Financial Institutions and Creditors Rights Practice Group in the San Jose office, with a primary focus on representing secured and unsecured creditors in the restructuring and enforcement of complex loan transactions in the state, district, appellate, and bankruptcy courts nationwide. Michael Malter of Binder and Malter is an AV-rated attorney with 40 years of bankruptcy related experience, and one of only 9 attorneys in Santa Clara County certified by the State Bar of California's Board of Legal Specialization as a certified specialist in bankruptcy law. And Ryan Penhaligon's practice is split between in-court and out-of-court, but his in-court practice includes bankruptcy, commercial litigation, and representing clients in a wide range of business, real estate, and commercial disputes with an emphasis on debtor-creditor rights and insolvency. Monique, Michael, Justin, Ryan, thanks to each of you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Legal Rights will be back next week at our new time of 6 o'clock. Our thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Debbie Kennedy, I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Loyal Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.